This is Yehuda HaKohen, Vision Movement, Vision Magazine, and you are listening to the Next Stage podcast. Chodesh Tov, we're now in the month of Nisan, the month of Chirut, the month of Israel's freedom, and what better time to talk about the U.S.-Israel relationship and the need for independence. A number of listeners have recently asked where my co-host Lizzie Uziel has been. You know, you guys notice when she's gone. I'm not going to disclose the answer here right now on this program, but if you go to our Patreon, if you go to patreon.com/visionmovement, we have an audio there that you can listen to find out where Lizzie has been, what she's been up to, and when we could expect to have her back regularly on the Next Stage podcast. So if listeners are interested in finding out what happened to Lizzie, where she's been, you can go to patreon.com/visionmovement, find out there. And while you're there, I urge you to become a member of our Patreon community and help support this program and others like it so that we can stay independent. Now we have a very interesting guest on this episode of the Next Stage podcast, Bruce Brill from Kfar Eldad, the Eldad village in southern Judea, just near Tekoa. Bruce recently put out a book called Deceit of an Ally, a memoir of military anti-Semitism, NSA's secret Jew room, and Yom Kippur War treachery. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Yehuda. Thanks for having me.
Right, so you yourself worked for the NSA, right, in a previous life, is that correct?
That's correct.
And you just put out a book about your experiences specifically as a Jew at the NSA in the early 1970s.
Also correct.
Now, you know, if anybody's interested in Bruce's backstory, we actually have that for you from a recent book launch at our Patreon page, patreon.com/visionmovement. You can check out not only Bruce's story of how he got to the NSA, but also a special presentation by Jonathan Pollard, who was also there that night, and his, I guess we can say, commentary on Bruce's story. That's also available at our Patreon page. But now I want to really get to the meat of your book and your story and what it means in terms of Israel's narrative of the Yom Kippur War, what happened there, what it means, and what lessons we can draw from it in terms of the challenges we're confronting today. So, Bruce, first of all, let's just put it on the table. You were an NSA analyst?
Correct.
And you were there, you were on base when the Yom Kippur War broke out, when Egypt and Syria attacked Israel.
Right, I was in the middle of my service at my permanent duty station at Fort Meade, Maryland. That's the home base of NSA. It's a huge complex. People don't realize that even back in the early 1970s, when I was working there, it was much larger than the CIA. And everyone had heard of the CIA, but nobody heard of NSA, hardly anybody. In fact, we used to joke that NSA stood for no such agency, because they kept a very low profile. Of course, that's changed since Edward Snowden.
For sure.
So, very quickly, how did I wind up in NSA? Back in the late 60s and very early 70s, the Vietnam War was in full swing, and Uncle Sam was looking for warm bodies. And so many of draft age young men like myself avoided the draft by getting deferments. While I was in college, I had a student deferment, and after college, I had a teacher's deferment. It's called an occupational deferment. However, in 1970, Uncle Sam needed even more warm bodies and instituted the draft lottery. And lucky me, my number came up. I was number 51. I knew I'd be going, and I didn't dodge the draft. If my number came up and Uncle Sam tapped me on the shoulder, I was going. So when you know you're going, you take some battery of pre-enlistment tests and see if you qualify for certain jobs. And I aced the ALAT, the Army Language Aptitude Test, and they offered me language of my choice. And I joke and I say, what would you like? Chinese, Cambodian, Laotian, Vietnamese, or Arabic? And of course, I chose Arabic. They didn't offer Hebrew at the time. That would have been my first choice, but they didn't offer when I was going in April of 1971. And after a 47-week language training course at Dilliwick, Defense Language Institute, West Coast, we called it Dilliwick, we went for security training at Goodfellow Air Force Base for some weeks in San Angelo, Texas. And after that, permanent duty station, Fort Meade, Maryland.
So,
okay. So here I am working as an Arabic linguist and a Mideast analyst at NSA. My immediate supervisor was a Jew hater, and it wasn't pleasant working under him. He was always out to get me. So I was always very careful, particularly with security matters.
Right.
Once I arranged in 1973, in October, it was October 4th, a Thursday, I arranged for a medical treatment. I had wrenched my back on a hill climb competition in California where I was stationed at Dilliwick. And I was getting some occasional regular treatments for my back, my upper back. And this one particular time, I arranged for my treatment to be at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Thursday, October 4th, when my immediate lovely supervisor calls down to the medical clinic and the nurse tells me that I have a phone call at the desk. I go over to the desk and pick up the black receiver. The color of the receiver is very important. Otherwise, why would I mention that it happened to be black? Black meant that it was insecure. And he, in this phone call, said, don't even think about going home this weekend, because if you do, I'll be calling your young ass right back down on your holiday. What holiday was that? Yom Kippur fell on Saturday, October 6th. On the first day of the war, I was monitoring live communication from the battlefront. Now, I can't go into detail about what I heard and from whom I heard it, but it was live communication from the battlefront, and I'm listening to this communication of an Israeli soldier, and I am thoroughly surprised that he and his comrades were surprised. Because my supervisor had told me not only that, I don't know what kind of listeners you have on your podcast, so I won't say the four-letter word that starts with SH, but the sh hits the fan on Saturday. And I asked him, certainly this must be another false alarm, because back particularly in January, February, May, we had these false alarms where Arab troop movements were very worrisome, and it looked like they could be staging for an attack against Israel. But we knew that these were false alarms, and we had them several times in the months prior to early October. So I said to my supervisor, surely this is another false alarm. And he said, no. This time, the SH hits the fan for real this time. It hits the fan on Saturday. I said, but still, it might be a false alarm. He said, no. This time it's a vowel, meaning there was no doubt it was really going to happen. And it did.
So, Bruce, if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is that your direct supervisor at the NSA told you prior to the Yom Kippur War, prior to the attack by Egypt and Syria on Israel on Yom Kippur, which was also on Shabbat on Saturday, he told you that he has absolutely no doubt that this war would break out on Yom Kippur.
Yeah, not only that, Yehuda, when I began writing the book, a publisher said, do you have any corroboration? And I said, well, when I was getting out of the army, I took a polygraph test in order to go through what was called a conversion process. It had nothing to do with religion. It had to do with converting from being military to continuing to work at NSA as a civilian. So you converted. That's what it was called. It was a four-step process. And one of the steps of the process was a lie detector test, an interview under polygraph conditions. And I was asked, this is, of course, after the Yom Kippur War, after I knew that somehow we didn't get the intel to our Israeli friends. And I also knew that over 2,600 Israeli soldiers were killed, and most of them unnecessarily because they were caught by surprise. The interviewer asked me, can you foresee any circumstance in which you would pass classified information to a foreign national? And I answered, no. And he said, you seem to be having a problem with that one. And I was, because something smelled that we didn't get the definite intelligence that we had in our hands to the Israelis, and that forced them to be caught with their pants down and lost 2,600 soldiers, mostly unnecessarily. Yes, I was having a problem with that one. And I explain in my book how I wasn't lying, but I was lying. How could that be? Because the question that I heard was, would you pass classified information to a foreign national under general circumstances? And certainly not. And I told the truth. But what I heard in the question, my subconscious, was, if Israel or any country, any ally of America, needed to know the information that we had in our hands so that they would not be caught with their pants down, because there were people in the agency that worked against stated American foreign policy, namely that Israel is our ally, yet we're going to delay getting this vital information to them, then yes, I would, under those circumstances, pass classified information to a foreign national. So I was caught in a lie. I didn't know at that time that not only didn't we get the proper intelligence to the Israelis in time, which was what I assumed, but what I found out 6 years ago, when I sat across the kitchen table from General Eli Zaira, who is the head of Israel military intelligence, Amman, he confided in me that he received an American intelligence assessment prior to the outbreak of hostilities that the Arabs have no intention to attack. They will not attack. And I'm sitting across the kitchen table from a general at his home in North Tel Aviv. And I'm telling him, I was hardly even a buck sergeant. I was, my rank was specialist fourth class. That's not even a sergeant. I'm sitting across a table from a general who is the head of Israeli intelligence. I knew that the Arabs were going to attack days in advance. I knew that it would commence on October 6th. And this general didn't know?
Well, it's not only that the Americans knew in advance that we would be attacked, and it's not only that the Americans did not share that information with us, it's also that they threatened us not to launch a preemptive strike. They threatened us by saying we'd be on our own if we were to do what we had done in the Six-Day War.
Right, right. So you're interviewing me about my book, Deceit of an Ally. And I have to say that there are different organizations that find the title problematic because it sounds anti-American. And I'm the furthest thing from somebody who's anti-American. I'm very pro-American. I'm very proud to be American. I mean, I enlisted in the Army during the Vietnam War for 4 years. I enlisted for 4 years. How anti-American is that? So the title of my book, Deceit of an Ally, sounds anti-American, but I assure you and your listeners that if it's anything, it's anti-American, because after the visit with Elie Zaira, people told me, Bruce, you've got to write a book. And I began investigating all of the aspects surrounding what is earth-shaking about my disclosures. And what I found out was many things that need to be shared. There are over 1,300 books written on the Yom Kippur War. None of them, not one, comes close to uncovering why Israel was caught with her pants down. So this is explosive in that sense. But also, you mentioned Kissinger. Threatening Israel, don't shoot the first bullet. And this is what Moshe Dayan confirms and so forth. It's true that Kissinger wanted to see Israel bleed a little bit so that the Arabs felt that they had a victory and then a peace process could begin. And the Oslo process began only because the Arabs felt that they had a victory in the Yom Kippur War. Now, you heard me call it the Oslo process. I don't call it a peace process, because if anything, it was more like a war process. And I think October 7th confirms this. There was another book written that I didn't mention at Pomerantz, but I'm getting it published. I call it The Kissinger Connection. So it's interesting that you mention Kissinger. Kissinger understood that the only way that the Arabs would enter into a peace process would be if they felt that their honor was restored to them by being granted a victory. So he orchestrated what is known as an orchestrated war, with the cooperation, of course, of Sadat and Assad and the Soviets, and I hope your listeners are sitting down, Moshe Dayan and Golda Meir.
Can you elaborate on that?
A little bit. I can elaborate a little bit. This book is going to be, I don't know if you heard the phone ring. The phone that just rang was the Hebrew graphic artist that's doing the layout on this book. In Hebrew, the book is called HaKesher HaMiruba. The translation into English would be kind of funny, the quadrilateral connection. But what it means is a four-point connection, namely the Americans, the Arabs, the Soviets, and the Israelis. Moshe Dayan and Golda Meir were accomplices, according to this book, in granting the Arabs a victory. It didn't go exactly according to plan. There were only supposed to be only a couple few hundred Israelis sacrificed in this orchestrated war, not a couple thousand. And that's what happened. Over 2,600 Israelis fell, mostly unnecessarily. And the intelligence was not only hidden from the Israelis, but false intelligence assessment was given to the Israelis, according to General Elie Zaira, over his kitchen table, that he was given a false assessment that the Arabs would not attack.
Right. So if the Israeli military establishment understood from the Americans that the Arabs would not attack, that Egypt and Syria would not attack. And Kissinger threatened the Israelis not to launch a preemptive strike while assuring us that we would not be attacked. In what way were Moshe Dayan and Golda Meir complicit in what the Americans...
Okay. According to this book that I'll hopefully get out within a week or two, I know I've said that before some months ago, but this time I'm really close to getting it out.
This is your book? You're the author of this book?
No, the author of the book is an elderly man who is 82, going on 83. I don't know when his birthday is. He's an elderly man who put the book out in 1978. He put the book out in 1978. He began distributing it, and then he received a threat on his life to remove the book from the shelves of the bookstores and to keep his mouth shut. And so this book has been suppressed for 45 years, and it's by time that it gets out. And how I got my hands on this book is what I call a finger of God experience. Parenthetically, I'll mention what that experience was. I called a lady that I play music with, a single lady, and a guy answers her phone. And he tells me that he found this phone in Jerusalem. Do I know the owner? And I arranged to pick it up. And this was when I was finishing writing my own book. And he was a young man, maybe about 40, certainly born after the Yom Kippur War. And I was curious. I asked this of Israelis born after the Yom Kippur War. Would you buy a book that discloses the truth about the surprise of the Yom Kippur War? And he answers me, no. I said, why such an aggressive answer? He says, because my father wrote a book explaining the surprise of the Yom Kippur War. His life was threatened not to release it and to keep his mouth shut about his disclosures. And so the only people that he shares his disclosures with is his immediate family. And that's why his abrupt and aggressive answer. And then he takes me to his home and he finds a copy of the book and gets it to me. And I meet his father, and his father, at first reluctantly, but after some friendly persuasion, he agreed that I can publish his book. And not only publish it, but I've gotten it translated into English. And so it'll go up on Amazon, both English and Hebrew, in just a few weeks.
Wow. And can you share with our listeners what the connection was with Golda Meir and Moshe Dayan in this story?
Okay, so Kissinger persuaded them that the only way to bring a true and lasting peace would be to grant the Arabs a victory in a war, because they said they publicly, pronouncement after pronouncement, that they will not accept return of the occupied territories, but in war. Because what was taken by force of arms has to be returned by force of arms. And so they were agreeable that it should be a modified victory with very few losses. I have to tell you about something that kind of confirms this idiocy. I met a man named Dani Ben Yaakov, and it was by chance that I met him. I was shopping for a book in the Book Maven on Agrippa Street. It no longer exists. It was a secondhand bookstore. And I met this man, Dani Ben Yaakov, who saw me looking for books on the Yom Kippur War. And he told me that he was an advisor to the Matkal, the command staff. He was an advisor to the command staff. And a day or two before the Yom Kippur War broke out, he suggested executing a contingency plan that called for the removal of all the soldiers on the Barlev line, That's the string of fortifications along the east bank of the Suez Canal, because they had no chance in hell to stand up against a full-blown Egyptian army crossing of the Suez Canal. They had no chance. So the contingency plan was very simple. The removal of all the boys, and there were over 400 boys on the east bank of the Suez Canal, and in their place, remotely detonatable high explosives. Let the Egyptians cross the canal, let them congregate at the fortifications, and then blow them to smithereens, and then counterattack. It was a contingency plan that required 24 hours to implement, only 24 hours, and it was brilliant. It was a brilliant plan. It wouldn't have cost anything, and it would not have been interpreted by the Americans, by Kissinger, as aggressive. After all, you're withdrawing your boys from the front line. But it was poo-pooed by Elie Zaira, and it wasn't implemented. And most of those 400 boys on the Barlev line were either wounded or killed or taken captive, most all of them. It was a terrible price to pay. I mean, even the ones that were taken captive was a very, very high price to pay for Israeli honor.
So if I understand correctly what you're saying, or what this book is claiming, not your book, but this other book, is that Golda Meir and Moshe Dayan had been convinced by Kissinger that the Egyptians need to conquer the Sinai in war from Israel after the Six-Day War in order for them to be psychologically ready for peace, for some kind of peace negotiation with Israel. But I guess the question I would have is, if they already conquer the Sinai militarily, what do they need a peace agreement with Israel for, from their perspective?
Well, they wouldn't conquer the whole Sinai. They would just conquer the east bank of the Suez Canal and maybe 10 or 15 or maximum 20 kilometers along the east bank of the Suez Canal, which is exactly what they did. They never moved further than that. They did have an attack about a week or so into the war that was repulsed by the Israelis. Mm-hmm. So in the end, they didn't advance more than just over the east bank of the canal.
So basically the idea is that Israel's leadership expected a very limited Egyptian victory, a relatively clean Egyptian victory, and then the Egyptians and the Syrians just kept on pushing.
Right. Well, any of your listeners that know about how the war progressed over the 3 weeks of the war, was that the Egyptians really didn't advance. They tried on one occasion to get to the Mitla Pass, but they were repulsed with terrible losses. And so they were licking their wounds. Meanwhile, Arik Sharon, against the command, the instructions of Chaim Bar-Lev, whom, by the way, I knew personally, crossed the canal to the West Bank and cut off the Egyptian Third Army, which was in the south. He was then going to cut off the Egyptian Second Army in the north. And when he cut off these armies, well, for sure he cut off the Third Army, they had no supply of food or water even. So it would have been a total surrender and a total humiliation. So then Kissinger and had the Soviets pressure Israel at the UN to allow food and water to be delivered to the Third Army. Sounds very similar to things that are happening today in Gaza, doesn't it?
To a certain extent. But I have a lot of questions on this still. I want to make sure I understand the story you're presenting. Did Prime Minister Golda Meir and Moshe Dayan, did they know that the attack would be on Yom Kippur?
I think not. I don't know. I really don't know. I know that Elie Zaira did not know. And the reason that I believe that he was not accomplice to this Kissinger connection is how he confided in me that he received this false intelligence assessment. because it was written time and time again that not only was Israel fooled, but foreign intelligence services were also fooled. As a matter of fact, the head of the American intelligence services, who testified before Congress in 1975, like a little over a year after the Yom Kippur War, this Ray Klein testified before Congress that all of the American intelligence agencies were fooled, that the Arabs succeeded in fooling all the American intelligence agencies. When I discovered this testimony, the testimony was from 1975, but I didn't come across it until the early 90s, when I stumbled upon a New York Times article in the archives of Hebrew University Library, the National Library in Givat Ram, from September 12, 1975, in which, as part of the Otis Pike Commission investigating how taxpayer money was misspent in intelligence work, this Dr. Ray Klein testified that all of the American intelligence agencies were fooled. I said, what? We weren't fooled. We all knew it. As a matter of fact, in researching for my book, I contacted three other Arabic linguists that worked with me in NSA. And the other three knew before I did that the Arabs were going to attack. So we weren't fooled. So why did he lie under oath, so help him God? Why did he lie? Because he was part of the conspiracy to create this victory for the Arabs.
Okay, so I want to make sure I'm getting this right. We're saying that Henry Kissinger wanted the Egyptians to have a victory over Israel in order for them to be ready to negotiate peace. That Golda Meir and Moshe Dayan were somehow involved in this, but did not know that we would be attacked on Yom Kippur. That Israel was told by the Americans specifically we would not be attacked, meaning General Zaira was given information that said we would certainly not be attacked. And Kissinger threatened Israel that we cannot launch any preemptive strike. Not only were we not going to be attacked, but we cannot launch a preemptive strike or suffer the consequences.
Right. This puzzle is so complex that it's taken 50 years to find out all the pieces of the puzzle to put them together. And that's basically what I did in my book. And my book, in combination with this other book, which complements all of my disclosures, finally, we understand what happened. And then the question might be asked, if NSA was so good at finding out the truth of Arab intentions, back in October of last year, were they also fooled, like Ray Klein said they were fooled 50 years ago? Or did they really know? And was it a repeat of history that they informed the Israelis not to be prepared for something that they knew was going to happen, telling the Israelis that nothing is going to happen? And of course, I don't know. But of course, I also am very suspect because of what I do know happened 50 years ago.
Right. There's another similarity there. If we're going to draw parallels between what happened in the Yom Kippur War 50 years ago and what happened on October 7th, the Simchat Torah here this year, another parallel is that the Americans cast themselves in the role of Israel's savior during that war, both then and now. Now, with the Biden administration sending those aircraft carriers and being quick to resupply us and make all sorts of public statements about having Israel's back, and then through those airlifts that the Nixon administration sent to Israel during the war.
Right. I recall when I came to Israel after I got out of the American Army, because on the first day of the Yom Kippur War, when I realized that we somehow didn't get the vital information to the Israelis, I looked down at my uniform and I said, maybe I'm wearing the wrong uniform, and swore that I would come to Israel. In other words, I became an instant Zionist in that way. And I came to Israel, and it was amazing to me how much we hated Richard Nixon back home. Everyone hated him. He was the media's punching bag, kind of like Trump is the media's punching bag.
Or the way that Prime Minister Netanyahu is the Israeli media's punching bag today.
Yeah. But how Israelis loved Nixon. It was like such a surprise back in 1974 when I first came to Israel after I got out of the American Army.
So what really happened there? Meaning, I'm curious how you think this information, how you see this information that you're presenting both in your book and in this other book that you've been given the rights to publish and translate. How do you see that changing the narrative that we have of the Yom Kippur War and the role of the United States in that war?
Right. Okay. So again, the title of my book, Deceit of an Ally, sounds very anti-American. And I really want to stress that if it's anything, it's anti-American.
In your book, in the title of your book, Bruce, you mention the NSA's secret Jew room. Can you share with our listeners what that is?
You asked me to speak about the Jew room. The Jew room is a misnomer because within NSA, there was, and I can't say what's going on there today. It's impossible for me to know. I left there 50 years ago. I left in 74. Yeah, it's like a half a century ago. So I don't know what's going on there today, but back then, even as a Jew, I discovered that there were rooms, plural, that were off limits to me within the agency that I had no access to. I was not granted entrance, and they were kept secret from me because I'm a Jew. How I found out about this is another little story, but I think what needs to be said is that John Loftus, who is an officer in the American Army, and he wrote a book called The Secret War Against the Jews. He interviewed several people that worked inside what's called the Jew Room. And again, he said it's an absolute misnomer because, number one, Jews are not allowed not only entrance, but knowledge of the existence of these rooms. Why? Because they work against Israel. And number two, it's not one singular room. It's a complex of rooms. So there's a cabal within the intelligence agency that works against America's ally. What could be more un-American than that? I'll tell you, if this cabal is taxpayer-funded and they're unmonitorable and they work against America's ally, what could be more un-American than that? So yes, deceit of an ally sounds un-American, but it's really anti-American.
Unless, of course, Israel is not a true ally of the United States.
Well, it's a two-way street. And I don't know, you know, from the Israeli side, I'm not the person to interview. You'll have to find an Israeli who's on the inside and what Israel shares with the United States. I do know that Israel does share a lot with the United States. And as an American, I can tell you and testify that when I went back to the United States in 1976 and got married to a lady who had been living in Israel for a half a dozen years by then, and we stayed with the head of the Hebrew department of NSA. We were his roommate. He rented out rooms in a house that he bought to soldiers and sailors who worked at NSA, and he jokingly called it Uncle Leo's Home for Unwed Fathers. And here now, me and my wife are living in Uncle Leo's Home for Unwed Fathers. And we also began working for a subcontractor of NSA in Glen Burnie, Maryland. Tektran. That was the name of the company. And we translated documents from Hebrew to English. What were these documents? These documents were manuals of military equipment that the Israelis captured from the Arabs. So these manuals were translated from the Arabic to Hebrew. But prior to that, they were translated from Russian to Arabic. So you can imagine, you ever play that game where you stand in a circle and you whisper a sentence, and by the time it gets around to the last person in the circle, the sentence has totally changed.
In my day, we called that game telephone.
What'd they call it again?
Telephone.
Telephone, okay. So here, we were translating translations of translations of translations. But this is intelligence that Israel supplied to the Americans, and that's what we were translating. So Israel does supply a lot of intelligence to the Americans. And the Americans, of course, supply intelligence to the Israelis. That's why Elie Zaira wisely relied on the American intelligence assessment that he was given over and above and in place of his own intelligence that he got from the IDF, from Amman. They were telling him again and again. There were all kinds of people that I interviewed for my book, and you can read it in my book, that were trying to tell headquarters of Amman that the Arab attack is imminent. But Elie Zaira relied on the American assessment. What did the American assessment say? That they're not going to attack. And he relied on that. And he convinced Moshe Dayan and Golda Meir that there would be no attack, according to what Elie Zaira told me. And not only that, but I have to tell you that my book has the unique distinction of being approved for publication by the Pentagon twice. Why twice? Because after I submitted my manuscript to them, they approved it for publication under two conditions. One, that I redact the sections that they require that I redact. And number two, that I don't add one word of new content. And after they gave me the approval, several things happened that I discovered that I wanted to include in my book. One of them was a protocol from Moshe Dayan on October 7th, one day into the war, October 7th, in which he totally confirmed what Elie Zaira confided in me, that he received an intelligence assessment from the Americans that the Arabs were not going to attack. So I wanted to include that in my book. So my book now has the unique distinction of being approved twice by the Pentagon.
I suppose the difficult part here is simultaneously holding the information that Elie Zaira successfully convinced Moshe Dayan and Golda Meir that we would not be attacked based on American intelligence that was shared with us, while you're also saying Moshe Dayan and Golda Meir were told by Kissinger that we would be attacked, but it would just be a very limited attack that we could easily repel and then, you know, sit down at the kitchen table.
So anyway, a lot of the missing pieces of the puzzle are becoming available to us. And I think, as someone who reviewed my book once said, your book raises more questions than it answers, which is good. Which is very good, because these questions need to be raised and need to be investigated. There are other questions. I'll give you a couple examples of some questions that need to be investigated. I don't know how many of your listeners know the name Joe Alone. Joe Alone was an Air Force officer in the Israeli Air Force, who was given an assignment in Washington, D.C. And I believe he was living in Chevy Chase until he was assassinated a couple months before the Yom Kippur War. And his daughters are really hot to trot on who killed him. Who killed him? Because Moshe Dayan quickly came out with a pronouncement that it must have been an Arab terrorist organization that assassinated him. Meanwhile, there was no Arab terrorist organization that claimed responsibility, which is something that they're quick to do if they were actually the perpetrators. So who killed him? And his daughters suspect that it was the Americans who killed him. The same Jew room crowd that screwed Israel as far as passing false assessments to the Israelis on the eve of the Yom Kippur War.
Right.
So that's a question that needs to be answered as well. Who killed Joe Alone?
What information did Joe Alone have that could have been threatening to those in the U.S. intelligence?
I don't know. They suspect that he might have known about the plans, Kissinger's plan to have an orchestrated war.
Okay, well. So do you think that the U.S. establishment views Israel as a true ally? Or do you think that Israel is what we could call disposable from the perspective of the U.S. intelligence community and the military establishment?
America is not like one person, and it's not one entity. It's huge and it's complex. And even when you say the U.S. intelligence community, that also is not one body. It's huge, and there are many, many different elements within the intelligence community. And I'll give you one example. I told you about my immediate Arabic supervisor was a Jew hater, and he wrote me a very, very bad eval, an enlisted man's evaluation, very bad. And it put me in terrible distress, because it goes into your permanent file. And if I wanted to convert, if I wanted to stay on board at NSA, that would have disallowed my converting to be a civilian. But middle management there saw that my immediate supervisor was there to screw the Jew boy. They saw this. And some of the people there came to my rescue. I speak about this in my book in detail, but one of the biggest disappointments I have about the Pentagon's review and approval for me to publish is that I can't mention the name of a top Air Force sergeant that came to my rescue. He came over to me, and we were not friends, but he saw that I was being screwed, and he said, "You're immediate supervisor, Mike," I can't mention his last name, he said, "I outrank your immediate supervisor. I'm going to write an evaluation report on you that will supersede and replace his bad eval of you." So that was an example of where there are good guys there that don't necessarily hate Jews. At the same time, I should mention, Yehuda, that I think in all of G6, G6 was the huge section of NSA that targeted the Middle East. In other words, Arabic speaking and Turkish and Iranian and Hebrew. I think I might have been the only Jew in uniform. I know there were other Jews. I was transferred out from under this Jew hater and transferred into the Hebrew section. And I know in the Hebrew section, the assistant supervisor was not born Jewish, but he converted. And there was also an Orthodox Jewish girl from Baltimore that was very good in Hebrew. She was a great Hebrew linguist. So there were Jews that worked there, but they were civilians by then. But as far as people in uniform, I might have been the only Jew. And so it would have been easy to dump on me, but for the fact that there were good people there who saw that I was being dumped on because I was a Jew. Now, the Jew room might have been unknown to them. I don't know. You could ask John Loftus. And I really recommend, if you can get in touch with him, I have his phone number. I visited him several months ago. He lives in St. Petersburg, Florida. He was, again, a non-Jew. He says he has the map of Ireland for a face. He was the head of the Holocaust Center in St. Petersburg. So there are good people, Semitophiles, that don't hate Jews. I'll give you another example. When I was in Arabic language school in Dilliwick at the Presidio of Monterey, I began keeping kosher in the army. I had already begun keeping kosher before I went into the army. And I tried to keep kosher, and everything in the mess hall back then, maybe now today, I don't know, but back then, everything was cooked with lard. You couldn't eat string beans without lard. Everything had lard. And I found out that the Air Force guys were able to get separate rations very easily because they were very liberal in their headquarters. They would claim to be Hindu or whatever and say they couldn't eat the food of the mess hall. And they got an additional stipend to their monthly salary. And here I am, I'm starving, I'm eating hard-boiled eggs and salad, and that's all that I was eating. So I went to my headquarters and asked about getting separate rations. And they told me to get lost. In our Arabic language class, there was a lieutenant colonel, and he said, "Now you go back to headquarters and apply officially," which I did. And they sent me to the post chaplain, who was a Christian. I don't remember what flavor Christian he was, but he asked me, "On what religious basis are you asking for separate rations?" And I said, "I'm a Jew, and just about everything is cooked with lard in the mess hall. So I'd like to get separate rations." He said, "On what biblical verse?" And I happened to know Leviticus 11. And so I mentioned Leviticus 11. It gives all the kosher animals and the non-kosher animals. It's very clear. So he opens his Bible to the New Testament, and he quotes, "And Jesus said, what comes out of your mouth is more important than what goes into your mouth. And he denied my request." When I went back to Arabic language class, the lieutenant colonel immediately asked me what happened. And when I told him, he was so pissed that he gets up, he leaves the classroom, he stomps down to headquarters. Inside of about 20 minutes, a runner comes from headquarters into our class, "Specialist Brill, you're to report to headquarters immediately." They had all of the approval ready for me to sign. So there are good people. There are good people among the folks in the U.S. Army.
Right. I guess my question is more directed at the system itself, those who craft U.S. foreign policy and the perceived interests of the United States. You know, where does Israel fit into that broader vision?
Right. So, again, I was a specialist fourth class. That's one of the low men on the totem pole. So I can't tell you very much about decision makers. I can tell you that the head of the agencies who testified before Congress, the Pike Commission, and I mentioned this, Dr. Ray Klein, was part of this Jew room crowd, obviously. And they're not above lying. They're not above putting their hand on a Bible and swearing to God and lying. They're not above it, so long as they can screw the Jews. So very often in top positions, you have such personalities. And here you have these guys with Jewish names, Schlesinger, Weinberger, Kissinger, who were working against Israel.
So where can listeners find your book if they want to read The Seed of an Ally?
Okay, so a friend of mine who was in my Arabic language class became a book publisher, and he helped me get it up and out through Ingram Spark. And Ingram Spark puts it out on different platforms. And I know two of them, Barnes & Noble's and Amazon. And there are others. I think there's like a half a dozen or more different platforms. But you can check it out on Ingram Spark.
Okay. And if listeners are in the Jerusalem area, they can head on over to Pomerantz Bookseller. And
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely Pomerantz. In fact, both the English and the Hebrew are available at Pomerantz.
Okay, fantastic. Well, you know, we've covered a lot here. I think we should probably wrap it up. But I want to thank you for coming on the show and sharing your story and your insights with me and our listeners.
Thank you so much, Yehuda.
If listeners are interested in hearing Bruce's backstory, what we can call the prequel to a lot of what was discussed on this episode, you can head on over to patreon.com/visionmovement and check out the recording available for our Patreon community of Bruce's presentation at Pomerantz Bookstore. Also, we have Jonathan Pollard's commentary, I guess for lack of a better word, on Bruce's story as a separate audio file. And if anyone is interested in checking out the show notes to this episode, you can go to visionmag.org/the next stage 119.